VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman John Curtis, a Republican from the western state of Utah. And we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Curtis represents Utah's 3rd Congressional District. He is serving his first term in the House of Representatives after winning a special election in November 2017 to replace Jason Chaffetz, who resigned. Congressman Curtis is a member of the House Foreign Affairs and Natural Resources Committees. He also serves on the House Subcommittees on Asia, the Pacific, and Nonproliferation, and Western Hemisphere, Civilian Security, and Trade. Prior to coming to Washington, Congressman Curtis served 2 terms as mayor of Provo City. He is also fluent in Mandarin Chinese and is known for his collection of stately socks, which I had the pleasure of seeing in his office. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congressman Curtis about a range of domestic and international issues facing the United States. We'll ask his views about U.S. President Donald Trump's approach to international trade, especially his handling of the U.S.-China trade dispute after negotiations recently faltered, immigration policy, the current impasse between the executive branch and the democratically controlled House of Representatives, and much more. Congressman John Curtis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's great to be here with you.
And thanks for hosting us right here in your office.
You bet.
Well, Congressman Curtis, you hold the seat previously occupied by Jason Chaffetz, who resigned before his term ended. What prompted you to run for office, and what are the issues that are near and dear to your heart?
Interestingly, probably the hardest question I get asked, basically, why did I run for office? I had been mayor of Provo, you mentioned that, and had already announced that I was not running for re-election. Provo is the largest city in the district when Jason resigned. And so I think there was a lot of people naturally looking to me to see if I was interested. And initially I wasn't. I'd seen it from the other side and it wasn't very attractive to me. But as I analyzed it, I really felt quite compelled to jump in and see if I could make a difference.
And I know that you were previously a Democrat and you changed parties in 2006. What prompted you to become a Republican?
Well, I think it's probably a bigger question is what prompted me to become a Democrat, because I was raised a Republican. And I think you have to understand the politics of Utah, particularly 20 or 30 years ago. We were so dominantly Republican in the state that I didn't think it was healthy. And offices were running uncontested. And I just felt that it was important to have a viable second party. And in Utah, there's just not a lot of difference between Republicans and Democrats. Our value sets are pretty aligned. And so I worked for several years to see if I could bring some balance and was not very successful with that and ultimately ended back up in the Republican Party.
So Utah is considered what we call a red state.
Yes.
Correct? It's a very Republican state. And it also has amazing natural resources, and you sit on the Natural Resources Committee. Nearly 60% of Utah's lands are managed by the federal government, and your district is home to some of the most iconic and scenic places in the country. As a member of the House Natural Resources Committee, what are you doing to ensure that these lands are protected?
Well, I love the question because it is a big part of what I do. I have Bears Ears in my district, which a lot of people have heard about because of President Obama's original Antiquities Act designation, and President Trump repealed that. But what people don't know a lot about is Emery County, which is near Bears Ears. And we just finished a bill, made it all the way through the House. The Senate was signed into law. That's 1 million acres of conservation, recreation, grazing. And we actually brought these groups together who rarely agree on these difficult public lands issues. And we're able to get a bill through, a substantial bill. And I think that gives us hope that we can duplicate that formula in some of my other counties. And this team and my office spends a tremendous amount of time on these public lands issues.
On that particular topic, it seems like the Trump administration, Mr. Trump in particular, would prefer to develop some of these areas and actually risk jeopardizing their protected status.
So that's really not true. I think what you're seeing from President Trump is more a leaning towards letting these decisions be made locally. And I feel like the people locally want to preserve and protect as much as everybody else. It's really not a decision of what we do with these lands. It's more a decision of who gets to make those choices and how they're managed.
In a related topic, let's turn now to the issue of climate change. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the Paris Accord. What are your thoughts with regard to
that? We just debated this in Congress. We had H.R. 9, which really was on this issue. And the problem with the Paris Peace Accord is fundamentally it gives a pass to China, to Iran, to these countries who are putting out vast amounts of pollution. And then, in my opinion, is discriminately hard on rural America and parts of my district. So my question to those who are pushing the Paris Peace Accord is, why is it okay to give a pass to a human rights violating dictator and then villainize people in rural Utah? And it's not about taking care of this earth. It's not about leaving the earth better than we found it. It's really about the fact that there were some fundamental flaws in that accord that, in my opinion, were detrimentally hard on rural America.
I see. But by withdrawing, that means the United States doesn't have a seat at the table to perhaps negotiate some aspects
I don't believe that's true. If you looked at the nations who did sign that, most of them fell into one of two categories. One is they were either given a free pass, in China's case, for 13 years to continue to pollute, or they weren't keeping up with their agreements. So that's not a table where I want to sit at, right? But I do feel like, to your point, America does need to show leadership, and I think it's incumbent on us to lead out on this. But I think that we do better touting our successes than kind of villainizing those who we have relied on for energy for so many years.
I'd like now to turn to the Mueller report, the probe into Russia's interference.
Oh, good, a non-controversial topic.
Right, into the 2016 elections. I'd like to remind our listeners that the report concluded that the Russian government interfered in the 2016 presidential election in sweeping and systematic fashion. The report did not find sufficient evidence to bring charges of any kind of criminal conspiracy with Russia against Trump or anyone associated with his campaign, but it documented numerous dubious contacts between Russia and the Trump campaign. The report did not offer a conclusion on whether Trump actually obstructed justice, even though Attorney General William Barr later concluded that he didn't think there was sufficient evidence for obstruction of justice. So my question, Congressman Curtis, is do you think it's time, as many Republicans are saying, to so-called turn the page on this issue? Or does the House Judiciary Committee, controlled by majority Democrats, have the right, and they would argue the obligation, to continue to investigate by requesting and studying the unredacted report, because we only have the redacted version, which they have subpoenaed, but which Attorney General Barr has refused to turn over, forcing the House actually to launch proceedings to hold him in contempt of Congress?
That was a long question. Yeah. Let me try to break it down this way. The Democrats have a very clear choice. We've got immigration, we've got budget, we've got some serious issues. They can consume all of their time reinvestigating this. And they don't have more tools. They have less tools than Mueller had to begin with. And they have his report. And it is true that parts of it were redacted, but they're not even going, Jerry Nadler hasn't even gone down to look at the redacted report and read it and see what's missing from that.
Now, Jerry Nadler, let me remind our listeners, he's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, mm-hmm. And so my point is not to criticize him, but it's to say, look, we've been thorough in this investigation, and I supported the investigation from the beginning because I felt like the American people had to know what happened there. But you said something that's interesting that is often totally overlooked, and that is that Russia did substantially interfere with our elections. That, to me, is what we should be talking about, right? We want to just keep boring in on President Trump and we're just totally neglecting the fact that we've got another election coming up in a year and a half, and we're not ready for it. And I would rather that we spend our time dealing with that portion of the report that nobody's even talking about, to say, wait a minute, we all agree, Republicans and Democrats, that Russia interfered with our election. That is unacceptable. What are we doing to make sure this doesn't happen in 18 months? That is what I would think would be a far more productive conversation for Republicans and Democrats, to say nothing of the other issues of the day, immigration and all these other issues that really need a lot of time and attention.
Well, speaking of Russia's interference, that leads me to ask you about the U.S.-Russia relationship. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Russia last week. He met with the Foreign Secretary Lavrov and Putin and so forth. Some critics might say, you know, is it wise at this moment, knowing that the Russians are continuing their nefarious activities, interfering in our electoral system as we speak, is it really wise to try this kind of rapprochement with Russia, who is working across purposes with us, whether in eastern Ukraine, Venezuela, in other parts, even in Syria, one could argue. How do you see that relationship?
I think there is no question that Russia should be viewed as an adversary. And you're right. As you look around the globe, you can see a number of places that they're interfering in countries and issues and values that are important to the United States. You see that everywhere. And that's not just Russia. You see that same thing duplicated with China, by the way, throughout the world. And that should cause us great concern. Now, it is a legitimate question to ask, how do we deal with that? In the case of China, we need China's help with North Korea. And so these relationships are extremely complicated. I would hope that as we interact with Russia and China and some of our other adversaries, that we do so with eyes wide open and clearly always keeping America's interests out in front of us.
Do you see prospects for the Congress to ramp up election security? Some might say that perhaps the biggest obstacle might be even the White House, because Mr. Trump has yet to actually acknowledge openly and overtly that the Russians did interfere in the election.
Well, I think that's one part of the Mueller report that both Republicans and Democrats seem to agree on, is that there was interference. I think frequently we talk about this interference with some confusion, and let me tell you what I mean by that. I think you need to kind of bifurcate it into two areas. One is in what I would call the manipulation and persuasion area, and the other is in actually getting in and hacking into systems. And while there is some evidence of that, that's really not the persuasive interference that really took place with Russia. It was more on the manipulation side.
Social media
and things like that. And so I think those things both have to be addressed, but they're really separate answers and separate problems. And the bulk of the interference truly was over on the social media side, which is disturbing, but not as disturbing as if they were actually into our election systems, changing tallies and changing votes and manipulating that system.
Some are saying that we need to have paper ballots as backups. Would you agree with that measure?
I actually talked to an expert on this a few days ago, and he brought up a really good point, and that is the very nature of our system makes it problematic to interfere, and that is because you've got all of these 50 different systems. And so you may be able to get into one, but you can't get into 49 more, if that makes sense, because they are independent. And so I think almost accidentally was stumbled into one of the best protections that we can actually have.
A good point, but then those swing states the Russians might want to target.
Sure, and we should absolutely be positively careful. And I think there's a lot of stewardship and responsibility on individual state, county governments to make sure that if they don't have the confidence in their system, you better believe they should have backup, right? A lot depends on how much confidence they have in their system.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Congressman John Curtis. He's a Republican from the state of Utah, and he sits on the Foreign Affairs and Natural Resources Committees in the House of Representatives. And we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a very loyal listener who recently wrote in, Nima Batali from Jigawa State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Congressman John Curtis, Republican from the state of Utah. Congressman Curtis, I want to turn now to what appears to be a war between the White House and Congress. Democrats on some key oversight committees are seeking more material pertaining to the Russia probe, as we said earlier, and they argue that they're entitled to this unredacted version of the Mueller report to Mr. Trump's tax returns to ensure proper oversight of the executive branch and to ascertain that there aren't any conflicts of interest. But of course, President Trump has vowed to fight all requests, all subpoenas from the democratically controlled Congress. And of course, Democrats are frustrated, saying that Mr. Trump is showing disrespect for the separation of powers. And of course, oversight is one of Congress's key functions in addition to promoting legislation. I just wanted to get your take on this particular standoff.
Yeah, you know, there is a lot of hate right now going both directions. And I feel like sometimes it clouds our vision of really what's in the interest of America to send perspective. as a member of Congress or as a presidential candidate, we're required to fill out layer after layer after layer of financial disclosure. President Trump has done all of that. He's met every jot and tittle of the law.
But he hasn't released his tax returns as previous
presidents. But this is my point, is there is no requirement to release tax returns. The American people elected him without him giving his tax returns. And so to use the law to force something that is not part of the law seems quite political. If indeed Democrats think that presidential candidates should provide tax returns, let's make it the law. So now you're not targeting a single individual, you're targeting the presidency. That's very different. It's a scary thing to me that you can politicize tax returns. Sure, they want him to do it, and sure, it would be good for him to do it, but there is no requirement for him to do it. So to force him to do it would be to say, all right, all presidents should provide tax returns. We're going to make it a law. Mm-hmm. Because if it's good for this president, it's good for all presidents. But in this dialogue gets lost the fact that he has provided all these financial disclosures that show, I mean, it's amazing what people know about us if they simply go and look at the disclosures we've filed. And nobody's talking about all that he's disclosed, simply that he has not done something that is not mandated by law that he do.
I guess the Democrats who are requesting this would argue that they're interested in this counterintelligence angle of the Russia probe, not the criminal one, to determine if Mr. Trump or others in the campaign may have been compromised.
So I would say, well, what was not in the Mueller report that you think you're going to find, right? And when does this end? And if it's his tax returns, then do you want to audit all the businesses that he owns? Where does this end?
But what about refusing to respect the subpoenas? Does that bother you as a member of Congress?
You alluded to the balance of powers, and I think that it's right and fair to say that Congress has the authority and the responsibility of oversight. And likewise, the president has the authority and the ability to fight that. That's part of his opportunity as well. And so sometimes these things will come down to the courts, and that's why we have courts, right? And we all want to be judges and juries in these things, and I'm quite content to say, all right, let's let the courts resolve this.
All right. Let's turn now to the U.S.-China trade war, and it's fascinating that you speak Mandarin. You've been in the region. You know the sensibilities, the cultural angle as well. The two parties were about to reach a trade deal, and then it appeared that China might be reneging or wanting to renegotiate some aspects of the deal. Then President Trump imposed 25% tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods. China has retaliated. This is an issue, I think, where Democrats and Republicans agree that China needs to be confronted. Its unfair trading practices are unacceptable. But do you think, Congressman Curtis, that tariffs are the way to go? Because in effect, they actually disproportionately hurt U.S. farmers and consumers. And they haven't yet been effective in forcing China to reform.
I'm smiling because you've got all my talking points.
Okay.
Yes, let's clarify that China has been a bad actor. Let's clarify that something must be done. And there is wide agreement on that. I view China as, when I was a young man, I think there was some sympathy for China as almost dependent on help from the United States. That changed, and I think we started to view them as our friend as I got a little bit older. And then more recently, that changed from dependent to friend to competitor. And now I'm questioning whether or not it's changed again to adversary. And it's totally inappropriate that an adversary would have unfair trading policies with us, that they would demand the types of things they're demanding of us to do business over there when it's not reciprocated here. However, there are a number of tools in the toolbox that were not used to try to right that wrong. I've been an advocate that those tools should have been used before we got to tariffs. You mentioned the disproportionate impact on rural America, and that is absolutely true, and the rural part of my district is finding that. But it's also true for small business. Large business tends to be able to deal with regulations and tariffs better than small business. My district is 99% small business, and every day I'm hearing stories of dramatic impact by these tariffs, and this latest round has not been good. There's a reason that there's the cliche that says nobody wins a trade war. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that play out. Two losers, if that makes sense. And we seem to be spiraling down. Now, can it be salvaged? It has to be. We've gone too far in this trade war to just simply walk away from it. I wish it weren't so, and I wish we weren't here, but at this point, we've got to be firm and we've got to finish it. I don't see really any other alternative.
Let me turn now to North Korea. The talks in Vietnam back in February ended without any progress. President Trump preferred to walk away than have a bad deal, which was applauded by many. However, in the meantime, Kim Jong-un has begun testing short-range missiles, and these talks over their nuclear forces continue to stall. What would you advise the administration?
Yeah, I was very optimistic originally. It seemed like we were making progress. It seemed like that first summit yielded some fruits. And I kept urging people to be optimistic. And I don't mind telling you that that's losing a little bit of its luster to me, that this is looking more and more like the predictable lots of promises with no delivery. And it just doesn't seem to be willing to have a serious consideration of what America needs in this. And so I'm a little pessimistic on what's happening right there. And that's worrisome because it doesn't end well on its current trajectory. There is no good ending here if this trajectory keeps moving forward. So clearly we need to keep the diplomacy going, but also start thinking about this just isn't going well.
How about, well, I guess sanctions too, keep the sanctions, because they
want... the sanctions are important, boy, but I'll tell you, my heart aches for the North Korean people. That's who's really paying the price of the sanctions. But we have no alternative. We've got to keep the sanctions on. We need some help from China on this. China can be helpful on this. And we've just got to find an answer that changes the trajectory of where this thing is going.
Let me turn now to the question of trade beyond even U.S.-China. President Trump has the foreign policy mantra of America first.
Yeah.
And some wonder, does he really have a coherent strategy regarding our allies and adversaries? He withdrew from the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of course, the Iran deal. He often criticizes our allies with whom we have shared interests and values while praising many dictators. And we saw last week the Prime Minister of Hungary, who has been widely criticized by many by undermining democracy in his country. He's exhibited other radical sentiments. So basically, Congressman Curtis, how do you see President Trump's approach to foreign affairs? Do you agree with that, or how do you see it?
Well, it really should surprise no one that the president that was elected to go against the grain is going against the grain. And it's painful. And it causes a lot of us, myself included, some anxiety. But he's delivering really what was promised. And it's kind of one of the things that's interesting about the president. When people complain, I frequently say, there is nothing that you don't know about the president today that you didn't know when he was elected. And so that is his style. And his style is to come in and blow things up and cause a lot of discomfort. And the question is, can things be put back together in a way that is actually better for America than when he started? And, you know, we're all watching very carefully as these things are happening. There are examples, and I'll give one of our NATO partners not spending appropriate amount of their budgets on defense. That has been very positive. There's been a really positive change and acknowledgement that they needed to up their game with that. And so I think people are watching to see if this style is effective, if it delivers the types of results that ultimately are good for our country, or if it damages long-term relationships, as you have alluded to.
Let's turn now to immigration, because it sort of sits at the nexus between domestic and foreign policy. And of course, just like President Trump has the America First mantra, you know, he ran also on this anti-immigrant message, not just against illegal immigrants, but even he has restricted legal immigration. And of course, now he's intent on building this so-called border wall, even though Congress has not allocated funding for it. He's taking funds from the military and so on. Do you think that's the best way to go, Congressman Curtis?
You know, I've probably given more thought to immigration than any other topic, which is probably similar to all my colleagues. This is a big issue. And I don't mind telling you, in my short time here in Congress, one of my biggest disappointments is that we have been unable to make progress on this. But I think, to be fair, this problem first and foremost belongs to Congress. The president is only doing these things because Congress is not acting. If we got our stuff together, and if we worked together as Republicans and Democrats, none of what the president did would really be relevant, because we hold the power to solve this problem. And so first and foremost, I think we need to blame Congress, and I'm a member of Congress as I say that. We need to work together. We need to find solutions, and we're simply not doing it. And I think in many ways we're letting the American people down.
There have been proposals, to be fair, to members of Congress, but I don't know that President Trump was ready to accept the compromises.
But we haven't even tested him, right? So let's test him. Let's pass something and see what he'll accept and what he won't accept. But to this point, Congress can't even come together to get something out that would make it to the president's desk. And I have seen both Republicans and Democrats fail at this. We were in control of the House. We couldn't put anything forward. Democrats have now had it 4.5 months, and I haven't seen them put anything forward that would pass that test. And I'm anxious to find that solution that would bring things forward. There are so many things that we need to be doing. And this is what I regret about the wall discussion, is it seems to boil down immigration to one issue, like, oh, if we could only do or not do this one thing, it would fix or not fix immigration. It is so much more complicated than that. And at the end of the day, we need to invest in all sorts of things at the border, facilities, immigration judges, and yes, barriers. But there's a myriad of things that need our investment and attention down there. Technology, all of that is part of the answer, and we're just not having those discussions.
So is it fair to say that you were not in favor of President Trump diverting monies that were meant for something else for building the barrier wall?
So I'm not quite sure how to answer that, because I don't like the method, but we do need to invest in barriers. But to say that, I don't want to get lost in that this investment is much larger than barriers. As I mentioned before, it's facilities, it's judges, we do not have near the resources we need when 7,000 people approach our border to deal with those in a way that's in harmony with my district. And my district would ask that we treat every single one of those people with dignity and respect. Not necessarily that they all get in, but they're all treated with dignity and respect, and we're failing in a dramatic way.
Turning now to our neighbors in South America, and you sit on the Western Hemisphere subcommittee, Congressman Curtis. How about Venezuela, a terrible tragedy? What should the U.S. position be? Yeah. We have allies. We're supporting Guaido, who is the more legitimate leader, where Maduro is ruining the country. People are leaving in droves. People are suffering. But, you know, it's a conundrum. What would your advice be?
I had a chance to visit Colombia and go to the Venezuelan border just a couple of weeks ago. And, oh, my goodness, it breaks your heart to see these people teeming across the border. And my paradigm was wrong. I thought they were coming across the border and not going back home. But they come across for a meal. They come across for vaccinations. They come across to try to bring some food back to their homes in Venezuela. And it just truly breaks your heart. I wish all of the United States could see what I saw down there. Now, your question was, what do we do about it? Clearly, I think the support of Juan Guaido is where we need to align. Maduro has not done anything of value for his country. And we need to use all the diplomacy available at our disposal and see what we can do to get Juan Guaido in power. And then we just need to rush in there with the aid that country is going to need. My goodness, the average Venezuelan's lost 23 pounds in 2 years, 1,000,000% inflation. Which of us wouldn't take our families and flee that?
Exactly. I guess the key is to get the senior military leaders to turn,
yeah,
to turn against Maduro. And I don't know what the role of the U.S. could play in that regard. But
certainly we need to be using all the diplomacy at our disposal and keep looking for avenues to do all we can for the people of Venezuela.
Congressman John Curtis is a Republican from the state of Utah. Congressman Curtis, thank you so much for your time and for your terrific insights and for hosting us right here in your office.
You bet. Thanks, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Ted Schneider. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.